Hello, good morning or good afternoon, everybody. My name is Carlos Patron. I'm with the Superfund program here in EPA. You are joining us for the U.S. and EU perspectives on green and sustainable remediation. I'd first like to start off by clarifying that while the title implies it's U.S. and EU, we are being joined by our colleagues from Environment Canada, so it should be U.S. Canada and EU perspective. So my apologies to our Canadian friends. This is an internet seminar that is serving to lay out some of the basics of activities, positions, drivers, and constraints on green and sustainable remediation from perspectives from several organizations, including the US EPA, Environment Canada, and some of our colleagues in Europe, as well as some organizations that are involved in this topic. At the CONSOIL conference, which is a European contaminated sites conference that's being held in Austria later in September, there will be a one-day session on this topic. The purpose of this seminar is to lay out some of the basic positions, drivers, constraints, etc., there will be some follow-up at the conference itself. So today we have several speakers. Let me introduce them. So you know who's on here, although you have information on the instructors and their bios on the main page. First, we have, after a brief introduction from EPA perspectives, I'll be introducing Dietmar Müller from the Environment Agency in Austria. Then Chantal Côté from Environment Canada, followed by Stephanie Ferenza from BP, who will be speaking on behalf of Surf USA. Paul Bartos of R3 Environmental Technology in the UK will be speaking on behalf of Surf UK. Laurent Baker from Tau Group will be speaking on behalf of Surf Netherlands. Olivier Moret will be speaking on behalf of, Olivier, please remind me, is it Eurodemo is going to be Dietmar, and you are speaking on behalf of Nicole, is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. And finally, Dominique d'Armandrel from France will be speaking on behalf of the Common Forum on Contaminated Land in Europe. So with that, you'll have this opening slide. I will be asked at the speakers when they advance your slide. They let everybody know that we're moving to the next slide, so let's all do that. Please click the advance button, and as you may know, put the question mark button at the top of your screen. You can click that at any time to submit a question. And as you heard, those of you on the phone lines, please keep the phones on mute and do not put us on hold. As the speakers advance the slides, they will let you know, and you can click the advance button. For the phone lines, we will be holding questions till the end of the presentations. So please hold your questions until the last speaker. Last final check-in. Has Dietmar Müller been able to join us?
Carlos? I don't know if you hear me now.
Yes, I can hear you, Dietmar. Welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Okay, so we're all on board. Let's go ahead and get started. So we should all be on slide number 3 now. This is my opening slide, and again, I appreciate all of you for joining us, both speakers and participants. It was very interesting to see the participant list. We have a great turnout, and parties from both continents and Asia. So welcome to everybody. As I mentioned earlier, this is a seminar laying out some basic positions on and U.S., Canada, and EU perspectives on green and sustainable remediation. Let's go to the next slide, please. I'll start with our position here from the U.S. EPA. What you have on your screen is a definition that we are currently using that was released in 2008 in a document, a primer on green remediation. And the focus here on the term green remediation in EPA is on contaminated sites and the work needed to prepare these sites for reuse or to protect human health and the environment from contaminants. So the definition known as the practice of considering all environmental effects of remedy implementation and incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprint of cleanup activities refers to all the work necessary to clean up the site, a contaminated site, to protect human health and environment, and or to prepare it for reuse. Let's go to this next slide, please. You should be on slide 5. The topic, the title of the internet seminar is includes the term sustainable remediation. And we like to use this Venn diagram to explain how there are several dialogues taking place that are not mutually exclusive. So while you may hear the term green remediation, you may also hear the term sustainable remediation. There's an overlap between the two. And as I said earlier, from our perspective, green remediation is the work necessary to, is reducing the footprint of the work necessary to clean up a site to prepare it for reuse. If that site is going to be redeveloped and there is sustainable redevelopment taking place, there's going to be a natural overlap between those two. There's also quite a bit of overlap between concepts of renewable energy on contaminated lands. There's an initiative here in the U.S. Led by EPA to use contaminated lands as places where renewable energy can be generated. There's also an ongoing discussion related to climate change and the greenhouse gas footprint of cleaning up contaminated sites. Again, green remediation includes the concepts of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions emitted from the work necessary to clean up contaminated sites. So again, these discussions are related but not synonymous. Go to slide 6, please. This slide has what we call the core elements of green remediation. In EPA, we've defined green remediation as having these 5 core elements that you see in those wedges, and they help us understand the environmental footprint of cleanup work and better prioritize the actions we can take to reduce that footprint. Naturally, each site cleanup project will have a different set of drivers depending on the location, contaminants, and media, and the treatment process selected to clean up that site. Another point to make is the footprint elements we see here are common to most construction projects, and in many instances, we are borrowing best practices already in use elsewhere. We can say this is not rocket science. Let's go to slide number 7, please. We may ask ourselves, does it really matter how much, how significant is the environmental footprint from a cleanup project? Naturally, it will vary depending on whether we're doing a small gas station cleanup or a large industrial facility cleanup. But we have run some numbers here in EPA. These numbers are from a fact sheet we're getting ready to release soon. And there is indeed a footprint. This is representative of a medium-sized cleanup project in the Superfund program based on multiple case studies that we have where we ran some estimates of what those air and greenhouse gas emissions could be. And as you can see, there are, for this project here, there are 985 pounds of particulate matter emitted. There are more than 13,000 pounds of NOx emissions and almost 1,000 tons of CO2 emissions from a remediation project. And this one is not necessary. It's mid-range for the Superfund program. If we go to the next slide, please, slide 8. This the footprint, the baselines, they're not only significant at each site, but there is still a lot of work to be done cleaning up contaminated sites. So looking forward, any improvements we make to the operations today will have a long payback. Go to slide 9, please. So what are we doing in EPA? The concept of green remediation is a priority at many levels. Our office, the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, which is for those of you outside of the U.S., this is basically the land office in EPA, the land and waste office, issued some principles for greener cleanups in September of 2009, and they lay out for all the cleanup programs in EPA. EPA, there are, in the U.S., basically, there are several cleanup frameworks, or regulatory frameworks, or which are RCRA Corrective Action, Resource Conservation Recovery Act Corrective Action, the Superfund Program, Brownfields Program, Underground Storage Tanks, and then State Voluntary Cleanup Programs. These principles apply to those programs managed by the EPA. And basically lay out that policy for all cleanup programs that we will evaluate the environmental footprint of the work necessary to clean up sites and take actions necessary to reduce it. The concept is also a priority in EPA strategic plan, and also at the federal level in the United States government, there is an executive order on federal leadership in environment, energy, and economic performance that serves as a driver for the management of federal programs. Let's go to the next slide, slide 10, please. So there's here in EPA, there's quite a bit of activity taking place. I talked about the principles for greener cleanups. There's a Superfund Green Remediation Strategy, which is specific to the Superfund program. There's work underway by the ASTM, American Society of Testing Materials, to develop voluntary green cleanup standards and possibly a certification system, which would be a robust tool for fostering greener cleanups across the cleanup programs. I mentioned the concept of power renewable energy on contaminated lands. That's the Repowering America. And finally, there's quite a few regional initiatives in EPA's programs. And fortunately, we don't have the time to present it here, but also some of the other federal agencies that have large cleanup responsibilities, including the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy, are also undertaking initiatives of their own to reduce the footprint of cleaning up their sites. Go to the next slide, please, slide 11. This is a link to some of the information, everything that I've talked about here, mainly on the cluin.org/green remediation. You'll be able to find the policy documents, the technical documents like fact sheets, et cetera, case studies, site profiles, et cetera. And with that, I'd like to hand it off to our next speaker, Dietmar Mueller, who will be speaking from the Austria Environment Agency in Austria, who will be speaking on behalf of Eurodemoplus. Dietmar?
Thanks, Carlos. Thanks for the introduction. Hi, everyone. I will try to briefly explain about Eurodemoplus, so you should be on slide 13. And move on to slide 14. So Eurodemoplus, in former times, has been a European coordination action, so it was a project funded by the European Commission. Since more than 2 years, we are now a voluntary network. We are serving as an umbrella for national and regional demonstration platforms seeking to exchange information. And we are about 18 partners from 9 different European countries. So the common interest is to assist and connect stakeholders on good quality demonstration practices across Europe and promoting innovation for safe, sustainable and cost-effective remediation practices. So we are really thinking that innovation for the future, also for the contaminated land sector, should be triggered by sustainability and that the economic and ecological aspects often are in line with each other. So moving on to slide 15, please. You see for what has been driving us, so we started off by a very general European policy, which is not strictly limited or is not related directly to contaminated land, but as you see, the Environmental Technology Action Plan is far more outreaching, so it's all for any technology you could think about. It was also the thematic strategy on the sustainable use of natural resources. Nowadays, it's the climate and energy targets, so the 2020 targets, so it's to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to increase the use of renewable energies in the last 20 years, to decrease the overall use of primary energy consumption in comparison to 1990. So we still expect in Europe the Soil Framework Directive, but at the time being, this is probably something which is more or less kind of a hindering block for further discussions on sustainability, because nowadays we are still debating about old-fashioned things like risk management and so on. There is for Europe hardly to describe the common market, but what is obvious that there is a decreasing awareness and willingness to act and pay nowadays, as there is a decrease in public funds. And compared to the US, I think that the sector here in Europe is kind of a bit more innovation resistant and very sensitive regarding uncertainties. So that's one of the big problems for new technologies or technology innovation, so that the site owners are looking really to have certainty on their investments, and that will be probably one of the keys also for any new developments for sustainable remediation. So the windows of opportunity are quite like where other places. It's a lot through redevelopment. Moving on to slide 16. So what we did, or what we want to draw our emphasis on, is really to look for the relations in between economic and ecologic aspects. So that's why we emphasize on eco-efficiency. And it's simply to get a better understanding and confidence, raise the confidence regarding innovative technologies and strategies by explaining and amplifying the eco-efficiency in comparison to technologies we are already used to since the early or late 90s. And as Eurodemo is plus as a voluntary network, we also, of course, looking for simply encouraging all the stakeholders for looking for their voluntary actions and norms. So we are still simply asking for commitment. We are missing a monetary background, so this limits our activities. Please move on to the next slide. So this is already my last slide, just to explain how we understand the linkage in between eco-efficiency and sustainability. Well, it might be understood like something in between green remediation and sustainability. So if you look for the three pillars of sustainability at the figure at the right side, so it's always about social aspects, economic aspects, and ecological aspects. We are not discussing the social pillar, so we're not discussing social sustainability or how to arrange participatory approaches, but we really look for the economic and the ecological parts. So, and that's quite an old concept, so it's simply looking for an analysis, and by the origin, it was something the production sector, the industry sector did to optimize processes and products and create benchmarks for. So we think we should utilize this concept. It's easy to understand. And you see by this small figure, there are kind of big ideas behind. So simply to look for these ratios for services we provide. So the services to reuse contaminated land, and on the other hand, to decrease the general use of nature. So that's what had happened also already, or was the big target during the oil crisis some 30 to 40 years ago. So we're looking for decoupling in between in resource use and the service we provide. And that's the final end would be this dream of a kind of factor four to, well, double the service and decrease the use of the environment by the half. So that's it for your demo. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate laying out the main points there, and you're keeping it to 10 minutes. I want to remind everybody we do have some questions coming in over the internet that we will be taking questions over the phone at the end. We'd first like to hear from all the speakers, but if you'd like to at any point, you can click on the question mark button at the top of your screen and submit a question, and we'll have it in queue for the Q&A session. And after the last speaker, we'll also be opening up the phone lines so you can ask a question as well. Appreciate your presentation again, Dietmar. Thank you so much. I'd like to hand it over to Chantal Côté from Environment Canada. Chantal?
Thank you, Carlos. So as mentioned in the title, so my presentation today will focus on the Federal Contaminated Sites Action Plan. This is a 15-year, $3.5 billion to address federal contaminated sites that the program has started in 2005. So the core objectives of this program is to reduce human health and ecological risks, as well as to reduce federal liability related to known federal sites. So there are currently 19,000 suspected sites on the federal inventory, and this represents a wide range of issues and locations. So typical locations would include military bases, federal harbors, airports, lighthouses, First Nation lands, and also contaminated sites on federal crown land that results of poor past management of third-party operations, such as abandoned mines that we have north of the 60th parallel. So we'll move to the next slide. So the members are federal departments and consolidated crown corporations, and we're seen to influence all of our program partners. And as this federal program has important linkages with other governmental priorities, such as job creation and skill and capacity development, just to name a few. So we aim to extend the benefits of the program more broadly to other members of the society, including the general public, local and Aboriginal communities, and also provinces and territories. So in terms of what we're trying to achieve, well, site assessment and remediation activities have both negative and positive broader impacts on the environment, on the economy and society over and above contaminated sites. So the sustainability framework that we are proposing to develop will provide contaminated site managers with tools and training to identify optimum solutions on a side-by-side basis, and we'll also provide best practices to enhance the sustainability of the chosen solution. So we're not looking at reinventing the wheels. There are really already really good tools out there and best management practices, so we're really looking in working in collaboration with other partners to mostly address the gaps. So I guess today's discussion is a good step in that direction. So we'll move to slide 20. So in terms of the drivers, so most drivers for integrating sustainability at the federal level are policy related. So we have federal sustainable development that reinforces the sustainable development practices within the federal government. We also have a policy on management of real property that calls for sound management practices, ensuring long-term sustainability and value for Canadian taxpayers. Longer-term risk management and remediation strategies need to consider climate change scenarios and adaptive management to ensure the integrity and security of the site management strategy. So our proposed framework will include additional steps to assess any potential issue requiring adaptation to climate change. So we'll go to the next slide. In terms of the constraint at the policy level, the first one refer more, I guess, to a risk. So some site managers could be tempted to sort of decide that it would be more sustainable to leave the contamination in place rather to use energy and other resources to clean up a site. So we think it's important in our framework to reiterate the federal program objective of reducing risks and liability, and also to consider some key principles when developing and selecting the best sustainability approaches. So we're currently considering adapting principles developed by our US EPA colleagues and SURF UK colleagues as well. Second bullet under policy is related to the fact that it is important to acknowledge that some sites may require completing remedial action within a short time frame and with the lowest level of uncertainty. So this should be taken into account, into consideration in the decision making. The third bullet is about demonstration and case studies, I guess. So I think that, you know, there are some good case studies out there, but I think we need maybe more, or we need to communicate those better. So those would be really helpful to encourage site managers to move in this direction. So in terms of the market, availability and market sensitization of sustainable technologies and approaches and best practices could represent a constraint at the moment, although we held a recent workshop with industry experts, and this was raised as rather as an opportunity and also a challenge for the remediation industry, so remains to see. So we'll move to the next slide. So in terms of the impacts of drivers and constraint on the scope of what's being considered, so as mentioned, we're aiming at developing and adapting tools and training. And we also need to develop suitable metrics to assess performance. And on how it is presented, so we're thinking of a flexible framework for the next 5 years of the federal program. So it wouldn't be mandatory. It's a voluntary framework for our members. So we're trying to encourage federal departments to consider sustainable principles in the decision-making process. So in terms of the platform, I've already talked about the principles and frameworks. So in terms of the incentives, so additional costs related to activities conducted under this new sustainability framework would normally be covered under the existing eligibility criteria of the program, as long as they're part of the contaminated site management plan. So we're thinking, for example, of the use of renewable energy, revegetation, including soil amendments. And so that's about it. And we're also looking at developing greener procurement practices. Go to the next slide. So this last slide shows a diagram of the sort of the proposed framework. So on the left side of this flowchart, you have the 10-step process that is currently used in the federal program, and we have added a step 11, like sustainable site reuse. So these are the steps that a site manager would normally conduct under the existing program, and we have added extra steps in the middle to put some emphasis on sustainable site assessment and remediation. So a key step would be 7A, which is the development of the remediation strategy, where we will need to provide like decision support tools to improve the sustainability of the chosen options. On the right side, we have listed existing tools and tools that we are currently developing. So as mentioned, we're looking and working collaboratively with other partners to continue develop these tools. And of course, we will need to adapt some of them for our context in Canada and focusing collaboratively on the gaps that we, the work that still needs to be done. So I guess in conclusion, I think some of the key conditions for a successful implementation would include adequate training, guidance, and some advice for the site managers to use such an approach. Readiness and the sensitization of the remediation industry to be able to effectively respond to these new program recommendations. Also, the need for site managers to promote sustainable assessment and remediation approaches through their statement of work. And finally, showcasing sustainable remediation projects and develop like a lessons learned strategy would be important for continuous improvement so that we can learn from each other. That's it for me. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Chantal. I appreciate your presentation. Thanks for taking the time, and thanks for staying on time. We now hand it off to Stephanie Ferenza, who will be speaking on behalf of SURF US. We are on slide 24, and again, if you have any questions, you can ask them at any time by clicking the question mark button at the top of your screen, or if you are on the phone line and would like to ask it verbally, after the last speaker, we will be opening up the lines for discussion. So, Stephanie?
Well, thank you, Carlos, and thank you for your introduction and the opportunity to speak on behalf of SURF in the United States. So let's move on to slide number 25, where I discuss constituency. For those of you who are not aware, the members of SURF were drawn from many communities, including the academic world, consulting companies, industry, and government. We have over 75 members at present, but under 100. And most of our members come from the science and engineering world, but we are seeking to, you know, increase our diversity, you know, in the social sciences and economic fields, you know, to better address the triple bottom line in the work that we do. SURF is a nonprofit corporation. We filed our papers in New Jersey, and we're also a professional society seeking to expand our membership both in the academic community and with students. We are about to open a student chapter at Colorado State University. In fact, the formal opening will occur tomorrow at our SURF 14 meeting at Colorado State. But because we're a nonprofit corporation, we refrain from any kind of lobbying or exerting influence type activities that would endanger the tax exempt status of the organization. What we hope to achieve is our primary objective, which is to serve as a forum for collaboration, education, advancement, and the development of consensus on the application of sustainable concepts to remediation. And we seek to look at these throughout the life cycle of a remediation project, from the site investigation through site closure. All right. We are now moving to to our next slide, which is going to be slide 26, where we discuss our drivers. Some of the drivers that we were responding to on a policy level, SURF started as a group of about 12 people from several different walks of life seeking to improve the practice of remediation. And another policy driver is the inconsistencies that are present at right now in environmental and sustainability policies, you know, that leads to some conflicting objectives. Another regulatory driver that we're responding to is the need to integrate sustainability into all the different regulatory programs that exist here in the United States, both at the federal and state level. Some market drivers that we are responding to is many corporations and governmental entities, such as the U.S. Department of Defense, have an increased focus on sustainability. And along with that increased focus on sustainability in general, there's a increased interest in sustainable remediation. As well, all these organizations are seeking to reduce their greenhouse gases. Another market driver is the need to increase our value in remediation expenditures. And this will also show that we're not just shifting burdens among impact categories. We're now going to move on to slide number 27. The constraints that we see in SURF. The first bullet, you know, was titled policy, but we changed it to knowledge because we really see that as the biggest constraint out there at many levels. There's a lack of understanding of the subject of sustainable remediation. There's an unfamiliarity with metrics, not knowing which ones to use and how to apply them. Definite unfamiliarity with life cycle thinking and life cycle analysis. And there's also a limited availability of data and tools that are out there for analysis of sustainable remediation. Another big gap that we see is the lack of a significant number of case studies documenting the benefits of sustainable remediation. And Chantal also pointed that out. Other constraints that we feel are out there in the regulatory process, it can be rigid. You know, some of the programs at the state and federal level can be very prescriptive and not really allow sustainability considerations or metrics as part of the cleanup program. Some market constraints is some of the tools that do exist for doing sustainability analysis in remediation are private tools and not widely available. Another market constraint is that there's really not a lot of experience here in the U.S. in balancing trade-offs between costs and benefits in sustainable remediation. Let's see. We are now going to move on to slide 28. Which are the impact of drivers and constraints that we see in SURF. On the scope of what is considered, well, the drivers that we have, you know, sort of the need to and the desire to improve remediation as we know it, are what led to some of the initiatives that we are undertaking within SURF, and I'll describe those in a minute. On how it is presented, well, we feel like it's really important in the remediation field because there are so many stakeholders from different backgrounds and with different desires that what we have to do is present our work in the most multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder fashion possible. So on the platform of what we're doing, so some of the constraints are what really indicated what we would focus our efforts on. So, for example, the main one being knowledge, that's why we really have focused on the root of education and becoming a professional society and fostering ties with universities. We're looking to develop a training module on sustainable remediation. Another technical initiative that we have going on that I don't have listed is the development of a guidance for how to use life cycle analysis in remediation. And we think that'll be very influential and helpful and really follow in the footsteps of the SURF white paper. We're also looking to develop a framework that will be, you know, sort of a synthesis of some efforts that are going on in the U.S., but you know, won't be repetitive. And we're also looking at mapping of metrics. And I don't have a conclusion slide, but I'd like to say in conclusion, you can find out a lot about SURF if you go to our website, www.sustainableremediation.org, and I'll be happy to answer questions later. And thank you so much. And with that, I'll wrap up.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you very much. And as a reminder, at the end of the Internet seminar, we have a link to additional resources. So in addition to any links that the speakers provided in their presentations, all those have been compiled into one page, so you can go to all of them at once. And also, I had a question about printing out the slides. If you click on the Save button at the top, you can download the presentations in a PDF format and save them, print them, or do whatever you wish. With that, just one more reminder. There is some noise on the phone line, so please remember to keep your phones on mute. Shuffling papers or moving the the headset or can cause interference. So please remember to keep your phones on mute. And with that, I'll hand the mic off to Paul Bordos. Paul?
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Carlos, for the kind invitation and for organizing this. I'm going to talk about a network in the UK called Surf UK, which was inspired by the Surf Network in the US, but it's not directly connected. So with that, can we move on to slide 30? There are a number of co-authors of this presentation which reflect it's a cross-sectoral initiative. So we have regulators, development agencies, some major industries involved, and Dave Ellis is our point of contact with SURF in the US. So we move on to the next slide, slide 31. I'm briefly going to run through SURF UK, its constituency, drivers and constraints, then explain to you the impacts that has had on our framework, introduce you to our publications and tell you what we're doing next. Now, I noticed that somebody from Ohio is asking, what is the difference between green and sustainable remediation? And I'll try and address that directly as I go through my slides. We move on to the next slide, 32. So, SURF UK, the Sustainable Remediation Forum in the UK, was begun in 2007, as I say, following the inspiration of SURF in the US. It's a collaboration. It includes regulators, industry, academia, and consultants. And it holds a number of open forum meetings. It operates on the basis of a steering group, and a number of people, if you like, who do a lot of the preparatory work. And then at these meetings, which have about typically 50 to 60 delegates, that's when the business is done, when decisions are made. The initiative is coordinated by CLARE. For those of you who don't know what CLARE is, it's a not-for-profit company set up in the UK to coordinate demonstration and learning activities related to contaminated land management. Now, one of the differences, might be a bit controversial for me to say this, between green remediation and sustainable remediation, at least as we see it in the UK and I think also in Nicol, is that green remediation is a concept that's developed from a regulatory standpoint, whereas sustainable remediation has a more encompassing constituency. I'm sure Carlos will have something to say about that. Our focus is also wider. So we're not just looking at how to select the best remediational technology, but we're looking to see how sustainability issues can contribute to higher level land use planning, how it can contribute to better project design. For example, the relationship between sustainability and site-specific versus generic risk assessment. So we're moving further up the decision hierarchy, as well also, of course, as having a very strong interest in finding the most sustainable remedies during remedial strategy selection and the implementation and verification. I think the third difference between sustainable remediation and green remediation is that our focus is not just on environmental elements of sustainability, but also on the economic and social elements of sustainability. So the goal of SURF UK has been to develop a framework for assessing sustainable remediation in an effective and practical way that has regulatory acceptance, and also to do some preliminary work on understanding what the indicators of sustainability might be. And we've completed those tasks, and that's what I'm going to talk about. we move to the next slide, please, which is 33. Well, there are a number of drivers. Industry in the UK has a number of drivers related to good practice, business ethics, for example. SAGTA, for those of you who don't know, is an organisation of problem holders in the UK from private and public sectors. So they have been one of the backers of this Sustainable Remediation Forum in the UK. Their website, by the way, is sagta.org.uk. And within regulations in the UK, there are a lot of words about appropriate and reasonable solutions, and sustainability forms a major underpinning for that. There's also sustainability considerations in the Water Framework Directive, which is an EU-wide legislation relating to river basin management, which directly affects contaminated land, and the Soil Framework Directive, which has been in draft for some time and probably will be for quite a bit longer, which describes the need for remedy selection to take into account environmental, social and economic factors. For planning in the UK, there are a number of tests and criteria for sustainability that have to be met. So we have cross-sectoral backing in the UK, and I think also Surf UK is responding to worldwide interest in sustainable remediation, many of whom are, of course, present in this seminar. So next slide, 34. Well, we are working on the basis of a voluntary code. We don't think that there's any route for having a mandatory code in the UK. We are also working to find a code that is consensus-based. And we've achieved it. That's a good opportunity. however, we've achieved that for the framework, but I think that this is going to be more difficult as we head into guidance specifically on tools and indicators, because this could cut across existing interests, because there are many tools, sustainability tools, which probably a lot of you have seen from a number of different service providers. I'm a little bit anxious about that. Next slide, 35. So we've made a definition of what we see sustainable remediation is, which is based on the Brundtland Commission definition of sustainable development per se, and that is the practice of demonstrating in terms of environmental, economic and social indicators that the benefit of what we're doing is greater than its impact. And we also believe that the best remediation solution is selected through the use of a balanced decision-making process. And I've lost my slides, I apologize for that.
135, Paul.
Well, thank you, Carlos. So moving on to slide 36, well rescued there, Carlos. This is the impact of these constraints. We have six key principles that we think underpin sustainable remediation. Clearly, protection of human health and the wider environment is paramount. We also have a principle about safe working practices, consistent, clear, transparent decision-making, good governance and stakeholder involvement. That means you have to engage with the people who you're trying to persuade, and sound science. Moving on to the next slide, 37. This is our framework. Now, it's a very simple idea. What we're saying in the right-hand side of the slide, 37, stage B, is that, yes, you can improve your sustainability performance by a good selection of your remedy. But we're also saying, in stage A, which is on the left-hand side of the slide, that you can have a greater sustainability gain by including consideration of remediation outcomes at the project design stage as well. Moving on to the next slide, 38. These are our outputs. This framework, which I've showed you a tiny snapshot of, and the review of published sustainability indicator sets. Those are available from our website, which is making me cross-eyed looking at it. www.claire.co.uk/surfuk. Moving on to the next slide, 39. I just want to emphasize the point that regulatory acceptance was very important to us, and we got all of the major regulators and policy branches in the UK to sign up to our code of practice in the introduction. Moving on to the next slide, 40, my last slide. This is what we're doing now until next April. We're testing our framework on the basis of case studies. We're working on developing our indicator categories further, and we're looking at benchmarking different sustainability assessment methods for the same sites. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for your presentation. Quick reminder, if anybody has any questions, remember you're free to ask them at any point, clicking on the question mark button at the top of your page. Looks like we're right on schedule, and I'd like to hand that off to Laurent Baker. And please correct the pronunciation if I got it wrong. Thanks.
Let's go to sheet 42. In the Netherlands, we're trying to start up a SurfNL platform. So it's also inspired by SurfUS and UK. It is an initiative by myself, Hans Slenders, and Alzalia Visser. It started during a workshop meeting we had at Nicole on sustainable remediation a year ago. The initiative was presented in the National Congress we had in the Netherlands last year, trying to introduce and to get more organizations involved. It was very positively received, and we have now about 15 organizations supporting us. To set up this platform, we also submitted a request to the SKB, the Dutch Foundation on Soil Quality Management, a CLARE-like institute for funding our platform. It's positive. We get a positive reaction from the management team of SKB, but it's still on the negotiation if we can start in the second half of this year. The objectives of SurfNL is how to express, embed, and balance sustainability in the field of soil quality management. So it's broader than only green remediation. We think that green remediation describes only the impact of the technology, and in the Netherlands we want to have sustainability incorporated already earlier in the process, so looking for sustainable solutions. So it's more than only green remediation. Also, we want to have some guidance on case-based projects versus aerial approaches. In the Netherlands, we're really looking at groundwater area management plans, so not only looking at only cases of remediation, but on wider scale. Also, we want to have interaction and communication with SurfUK, SurfUS, etc., for exchanging knowledge, and this made our knowledge from the US, but also getting the knowledge from the other platforms. And finally, like also Surf UK, we want to set up some kind of decision support framework based on existing Dutch frameworks like ROSA and the RAC tool, so Risk Reduction Environmental Marriage and Cost tool, to get more consensus on how to approach sustainability in the field of soil quality management. Next slide, on 43. The drivers in the Netherlands for sustainable remediation is that from the policy view, we see that there is a need for soil quality management. Soil is a common good. We have scarce spaces in the Netherlands, and we need and we want to use all soil functions in the urban areas, but also in the rural areas. Besides that, we see also that sustainable sourcing and procurement at governmental organizations is an issue. And, of course, the 2020 philosophy is already mentioned. So CO2 reduction, energy savings are very important. And especially in this relation, I will mention the integrated groundwater management already built, but also the implementation of aquifer thermal energy system, storage systems. If you look, of course, at the regulatory issues, the Water Framework Directive, but also impact for as a driver for sustainability. If you look at the markets industry, Still, sustainability is seen at this moment as cost savings, but also, of course, the sourcing and the procurement for image building is, of course, important. You go to slide 44. If you look at the constraints, we still see conflicting interests at this moment. If you look at the approaches for redevelopment of sites, it's very sectorial. That means it's only one view, for example, from the rural planning or urban planning, but then it's not involved with water or solar. So it's very sectoral approaches. And also the verification of plans are very sectoral. That means there is no integral overview at this moment used in the Netherlands. Also, if you look at the environmental benefits of soil remediation, it's not considered at this moment. We had already this REC model for many years, but we have seen that it was not used, and we're trying to give it a revisit at this moment, really to look at environmental merits of remediation, but then it's important how to balance that. If you look at soil quality management in a broad perspective, and you look at the soil framework directive teams, then you see some paradigms or dilemmas. You want to use, but you also want to protect the soil. And so exploitation versus protection of the soil. It's an individual good, but it's also a common good. How do you handle the debt? How do you go look at short-term developments, and how do you look at it on the long-term? If you look at fast development or slow development, and how can you include processes, soil processes, in that field, because you have most of the soil processes are very slow. Do you want to set it free or secure, the soil? Do you want to have it really centralized or decentralized? Really issues in the Netherlands because it was centralized for many years and now we want to decentralize it to the local municipalities. And of course, the ratio versus hard. You want to protect the soil because it's a natural resource and sometimes we spoil it, but when we are looking at more with the heart, we can protect it. And the last item, constraints, what we see is now the soil remediation business is a little bit fading out. That will also doesn't help trying to introduce sustainable remediation. Go to slide 45. Impact of drivers and constraints. So we see there are some drivers, so we see there is a will to introduce sustainable soil quality management, but there is still no consensus. There are a lot of opportunities. We are exploring these opportunities, but it is difficult to score, especially because of this sectoral approach. But we have already good examples. So we need really a discussion on the dilemmas and the approaches. We have already sustainable assessment, and it could be also a forerunner for sustainable legislation. We can adapt strategies from other disciplines to help us implementing sustainable remediation. We have to look at all functions of the soil system, so also looking at compaction, sealing, organic matter decline, etc. And we want to have an integrated approach, especially for the groundwater bodies. And these are the topics also we want to discuss on in our SURF NL. Next slide is... Oh, sorry. And this is my last slide. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Loan. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. So we move on to our next to last speaker, Olivier Moret. Olivier?
Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Olivier Moret with CH2M Hill in Europe. It is a pleasure for me to attend this webinar on the sustainable remediation. And thanks to Carlos and his team for preparing the organization. I will briefly present the work that we at Nicol have done on sustainable remediation over the past year and a half now. Do you want to move to the next slide, which is slide 47? First, a quick background on where this all of this came from. Nicol is a network of various consistency within Europe. It's a network led by the industry, supported by consultants, academics, and regulators. We have regular workshops each year. Our last workshop was last week in Italy, in Trieste, where we had a common workshop with a common forum. We also have a series of work groups. We started working on sustainability and remediation back in 2003, and you have here a list of some of the workshops where sustainability was touched on. But it's only in 2008, in October 2008, that the steering group decided to kick off a work group specialized around sustainable remediation. The charter for our work group was to provide a working definition that could be applied to remediation, try to describe how sustainability thinking can be applied to remediation projects, leverage as much as possible all other think tanks in Europe, in the U.S., and anywhere. And we've been collaborating with a number of them so far. And in the end, come up with a guidance document that can be used to support remediation projects of any size in Europe and maybe around the world. Our work group has about 20 active members, sometimes going up to 25 depending on the sessions we have during each of our workshops. We have 5 subgroups, one on communication, one on risk management, economics, indicators, and case studies. Paul Bardos, for example, is leading our indicators work subgroup, and a number of the people that spoke today are also part of the work group. If you go to the next slide, 48, this is a slide summarizing our position, which we feel pretty strongly about. This is based, this results of all of our discussions and thinking since 2008. First of all, we think that a sustainable remediation project is really about building consensus from stakeholders on the solution that benefits the best, considering environmental, social, and financial factors. And the earlier the stakeholders can agree on a project's goals, scope, boundary conditions, and performance indicators, that's really when the more opportunities will generate for sustainable gain. And this was already expressed by some of us today. We also think that green remediation is a component of sustainable remediation, typically focusing more on the remedial option appraisal once the strategy has been adopted by the stakeholders. We also think that in order to build trust, to build consensus, measuring performance throughout the execution of the sustainable remediation project is key. Now, the way performance is measured, we think, is not really what Nicole is all about. But the guidance document that we are working on will provide a list on tools and indicators that are used by the profession. We think that sustainable remediation is not a technical issue. It's really more about communication. Communication is the number one barrier and enabler for sustainable remediation. This is why it is so important to act very early in the process of strategizing a remediation project. We also identify clearly the conflicting interests between liability management or risk assessment and sustainable remediation. And we also favor a bottom-up approach, the objective being to start implementing sustainable principles on projects of any size and then slowly educating and training the community of professionals. If you want to move to the next slide, 49. This is just a summary of the questionnaire that was distributed last year on sustainable remediation. It confirmed, and it was distributed across all of our members, and we have about 100 members in Nicole, all over Europe. Confirmed sustainable remediation is a new concept. Sustainable remediation principles are currently referred to and used across Europe in very different ways. That's not a surprise. Legislation refers to sustainable principles to varying degrees across the European countries. Risk assessment is widely used and referred to in Europe, even though some countries are not yet in favor of risk-based remediation. Cost-benefit analysis, or the equivalent, is an accepted tool only in some of the countries, the member states. And economic and social impacts are not widely considered in remediation projects. So this helps us in developing our guidance documents. If you want to move to slide 50, this is showing what we called the roadmap for sustainable remediation. This keeping in mind that we want to come up with a way to help decision makers very early in the process of delivering a sustainable remediation project. And this roadmap is organized in two parts. This is the first part. Keep in mind that this is still on a draft being finalized. We hope to be done by the end of this month with a roadmap that could be printed in September once it will be approved by our steering group. The first part of the, if you go to the top part of this roadmap here, this is where the levels of decision making is made. I mean, it's pretty similar to what Surf UK, what Paul presented of the framework developed by Surf UK. And the lower part of this roadmap describes the remedial option appraisal is made and the execution of the project with the loop on measuring performance, demonstrating efficiency of your project. And any time you can go back to your strategy and design during the process. The graphical bar, which is in the center, which can't read very well, but it says sustainability assessment, is what is described on the next slide, 51. Sorry for the size, it's not very easy to read, but very briefly, the upper part is about engaging with the stakeholders from the beginning, defining your objectives, identifying your stakeholders, defining your scope, your boundary conditions for the project, defining even the way performance will be measured, what kind of indicators will be used during the process. Remember that this roadmap is supposed to be applied in any of any member states in Europe. So it needs to be as universal as possible. Then once the stakeholders have agreed on all of this, you can move into your remedial option appraisal, your analysis of the best solutions, and start implementing your project measuring performance. This is where we are now. If you go to the next slide, our objective is to come up with a four-page booklet in the fall of 2010, something that can be easily presented, shared in meetings, etc., and with a link to a full guidance document. And the full document will introduce how we came up with a roadmap, the work done by the work group, and there will be separate chapters, one on economics with a checklist of tools, guidance, references, one chapter on indicators, checklist, guidance, references, one chapter on risk assessment and how it can be linked to sustainable remediation. And we are planning to have the web-based dynamic archive of case studies that will be filled up over time when implementing this roadmap. We also are planning a pilot testing of the roadmap by whoever will be willing to do so, duration of which will be, it still needs to be defined, either 6 months, 1 year. And if you want to go to the next slide, I mean, that's my last slide for today. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Olivier. Thank you very much for your presentation. We'll now transition to the final speaker before opening it up for questions on the phone lines. But as you know, if you would like to, you can submit a question at any point, clicking on the question mark button. So, Dominique, could you take over now?
Yeah, thank you, Carlos. Hello, everybody. I'm Dominique Dalmondry. I'm the current Common Forum Secretary. I will start by a short presentation of our network. Can you move to slide 55, please? Our network is composed by land policy experts coming from ministries and environment agencies, coming from 16 countries or regions or province as you want, which is in Belgium, Spain, and Denmark. We have to consider federal and regional levels. We are born in 1994, and since that we have worked under voluntary or EU funding projects called so-called Clarinet or Caracas, for those who know. We have also guests from research networks or communities, and so we are already exchanges with Nicole, with Cabernet Snowman and other European networks, but also international networks, like the International Committee on Condemning and Banning, where we are working with the U.S., Canada, Australia, Russia, Israel, Japan, or China. Our mission is to be a platform for exchange of knowledge and experiences on contaminated land management. We are also initiating and following some international projects among our members or European projects like the one going on the FP6, that is the sixth framework program of research and development in Europe. We are also discussing with some other policymakers, researchers, or managers on the concept on contaminated land. Can we move to next slide, please? Who are you thinking to influence? Mainly, we are thinking to influence our governments, because being part of the ministries or environment agencies in Europe, it's our job to do that. But we, as I said, we are also discussing with other stakeholders like industry or communities, and therefore we are also trying to push some of our concepts for contaminant land management in their own system. In fact, what we want to achieve is that we would like to build a new concept for a more efficient policy based on risk management, but integrating sustainable remediation. And that should be done at the European level, but also at the national level. As you will say further on, we would like to have a clear added value of our policy and not to have an additional burden to any of what is existing at the time. If we move now to the drivers, so next slide, please. We've seen that at the policy level, the drivers are mainly what is existing at the national level at the time. As some of the previous speakers said, there is nothing on the soil policy at the European level. I will try to answer to John Cakewell's question about why the draft soil framework is enduring green and sustainable remediation. As you probably know, there under the Spanish presidency that last 6 months, there were no proposals for vote for this directive because there is no political consensus on this. It's mainly for different reasons, but one is about the methodology proposed in this soil framework directive. It's based at the moment, the proposal is based on a systematic inventory, systematic diagnosis, and systematic remediation. And there is no sustainable criteria involving the procedure that is proposed. Just to let you know, it's not currently at the Belgian presidency agenda, but it could be added if there is any positive signal to have a political chance to succeed. So at the time, everything is done at the national level. But if you look at the some of the EU European directives, like the IPPC, that's the one on industrial prevention of risk, the waste or environmental liability, or the renewable energy, all of them have sole provisions. And at the moment, they are not really consistent. So there is a need to integrate this in a better way. For the macro drivers, I must say that we do not have any figures as Carlos presented for U.S. Even cost savings, so the public funding program is really important. I do not have any figures to present today. If we move now to the constraints, so next slide, that's number 58. What can we consider for sustainable remediation? First question for us as a network is an important question. Do we need EU policy? And I must say that some of my members would like that I change this question on why do we need an EU policy. In fact, as Laura said, the sources are common resources. Mainly the problems and the some of the legal issues are already addressed by the existing EU directives, like the waste or the environmental liability, but some of them are not covered. For example, the biodiversity or the climate change, as previously mentioned, but also the land planning issues. And we need to secure, and I think it's a key driver here in Europe, we need to secure the land use changes for the future on the long term. And that's something really important because at the moment the key driver for the reclamation of contaminated land in Europe is the land market. If we look to the regulatory aspects, there are some constraints linked to the several levels of legislation currently existing in the member states. If we look in the past, we had a first generation based on a systematic approach focused on the soil contamination, so on the sources, that was already existing in the 80s in some of the member states. But if you look to Spain, for example, legal framework, it's still the basic principle of their own national legislation. Some countries moved to in the 90s to risk assessment approach, and mainly most of the European countries are at this level at the time. Other countries like Netherlands or France already moved to risk-based land management approach. This concept was developed by Clarinet, that was the common forum when we were paid by the Commission on the SP5 project. And this is already integrating protection of the environment and the land use changes. But as we are seeing, you at the stage of the situation in the member states, we can have the three levels of the three generation of legal framework currently applied in the member states. That's a real constraint, a real burden for the implementation of the contaminant land management and to integrate sustainable remediation in this legal framework. Therefore, we need more changes and more common tools to expand this new concept. And as it was said before, we need more information, more training, more acceptance of this concept. And that's something really crucial at the time. For my last slide, I will move to the impact of drivers and constraints. As I said, we need to integrate the sustainable remediation in the new generation, the fourth generation of policy that's already existing in Netherlands with the new update and what Laurent presented for the groundwater, for example. We think that this fourth generation of policy should be on the bottom-up approach and not, as we have been discussing in the past, for the soil framework directive on the top-down approach. And that was also one of the problems we have seen in the acceptance of this new directive. So we need to take into consideration the needs of all the stakeholders and to be really adaptive when the situation and some of the drivers are changing. We have seen the impact of the economic crisis on the brownfield redevelopment and on the remediation market during the last 2 years. And that's something also some of the governments have to take into consideration when changing their own policy. How it is presented, we think that one of the important messages is also to show the bigger objectives. Well, we need to see the global context to take into consideration when reclaiming sites on a sustainable way, is that you need to move from the site approach to a more land approach or a river building approach. That's something we need to integrate in the risk-based land management concept developed within the cabinet. It's why we did accept to discuss this new concept of sustainable remediation with other European and international networks, because, as I said before, we need to have a better consensus on the concept, on the criteria to take into consideration, and we need to balance the stakeholders, which is from the regulatory point of view and also from the industry or the community point of view. I think you can find more information on our website, that's commonforum.eu, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Dominique. Appreciate that. You guys might have noticed we're right on time. We've meant to finish at 11:25 Eastern, and that's where we are. I'd like to open it now to discussion. Maybe we'll start by this question that a couple of you have addressed. It was originally asked of Dietmar. The question is, could you expand on why the draft soil framework is hindering green and sustainable remediation of contaminated land? So, Dietmar, if you would like to address that question, or anyone else, and I believe some of you already did.
Well, probably I wasn't precise enough to. Of course, the discussion around the European Draft Soil Framework Directive doesn't hinder sustainable practices, but it hinders a shift of the general focus of discussion. So we are still having this policy discussion. We are still debating a lot of, let's say, 20th century big questions. And that hinders simply to move our policy discussions onto sustainability and to keep on track with other policies like the climate and the energy policies. So it doesn't hinder practices, but it blocks a really worthy discussion on sustainability.
Thanks, Dietmar. Let me open up any questions on the phone lines. Okay, I'll take this another question from the Internet. This is from Lynn Ackerson of Ohio EPA here in the U.S. And the question is, the social dimension of sustainability is often overlooked. How does SURF recommend incorporating the social dimension of sustainability into remediation projects? It doesn't specify which SURF, so maybe we'll start the same order we went through, Stephanie, and take it from there.
Sure. I'll go ahead and do my best at giving what I would consider the SURF perspective on this. I say, assuming that your remediation project is starting, so a new project, the same way you might think about everything on the project, for example, considering the site and the future use of the property, the community in which the site is, you know, the remediation site is situated, and working with the various stakeholders, there will be certain outcomes and impacts that are more important. And, for example, you know, just as there might be certain environmental factors that are specifically important, some of the social considerations might be minimize traffic through the neighborhood with the type of remediation project that's going on. So you maybe look to do more on-site remediation. Safety of the community and safety of workers on site. So in addition to reducing traffic, you might be reducing emissions from your activities on site, you know, so as to not impact the local community. Depending on another thing that might play into sort of the social dimension is, depending on the reuse, I mean, maybe the community is looking for, you know, the site to become something that will help provide jobs or access to nature or community. So I think every site is going to be different, and once you incorporate these things in the planning, it will become very, I think, much more straightforward to sort of figure out what those important social dimensions are and then track them during the project. And even if your remediation project is ongoing, there may be situations that are that arise during the remediation that will also point out some social aspects that can be improved. And so I hope that answers your question, Lynn, and I'll toss that out to, you know, to other SURF organizations.
Paul or Laurent, do you want to think it's been answered?
Yes. From, I think, Surf UK's perspective is very similar to what Stephanie has mentioned. We think that social issues have equal weighting with environmental and economic issues. That's a kind of a soft sustainability view. It's not a hard sustainability view, which would be that environmental issues are not tradable. So we have six broad social elements that we think are important. First, human health and safety. That considers not just the risk management performance of the project in the long term, but also in the short term, for example, risks to site workers and site neighbors from the remediation work itself. I know this is something of direct interest to SURF in the US as well. We also think ethical and equity considerations are important. And there's a good example of that, I think, in a lot of in a number of guidance documents I've seen from the US EPA, where there's a concern about remediation projects that take place, for example, in neighborhoods that are primarily occupied by a particular social group. Something else which is slightly different is what we call impacts on neighborhoods. And here we're talking about nuisance, really, things like dust, noise, odor, vibrations. but also the maybe some positives. Maybe the site had a lot of antisocial use while it was derelict. Maybe that would be removed, and there'd be a removal of blight by the remediation process. So I think for all of these things, they're positives and negatives. The other three, basically, there's what we have one related to community involvement and satisfaction, which relates to the quality of engagement in the process. The fifth one is compliance with policy objectives and strategies, how well you're complying with for instance, your local area plan, your regional area plan, whatever. And finally, by no means least important, we think we need a consideration of the quality of the evidence that's gone into the sustainability assessment and an explicit discussion of any uncertainties that are underpinning the sustainability assessment. So basically, my answer is kind of precising a bit the sorts of categories that we think are important under the social element, but otherwise my answer is pretty much in line with Stephanie's. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Paul. Again, any questions on the phone lines? Remember to take your phone off mute. In the meantime, let me take a jab at that. I think regarding EPA, as I mentioned earlier, there are multiple cleanup programs in the U.S., some more or less delegated. I myself work in the Superfund program, and I want to say two points on social considerations there, especially communities. You touched on a good point there, Paul. One is that community input on decision on remedy decisions is required by law under CERCLA, the law under which the Superfund program, through which the Superfund program exists. And there is a very robust community involvement program within Superfund with community involvement coordinators in every region and a very active group getting input from communities on remedy decisions. There's another aspect of the whole concept, which is the any impact that the remedy itself may have on those communities. And that's one of the focuses of green remediation, you know, looking at those, you know, call it nuisance, but sometimes this can be more than nuisance, but looking at, you know, the air quality in the immediate area around where a cleanup project is taking place, as you saw from that table I presented earlier on, you know, ozone precursors, particulate matter, and other, you know, dust and other such contaminants can be significant at the ground level. So any actions that we can take to reduce them will also benefit the community immediately around where the cleanup is taking place. So, any questions? Okay, let me take another one. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Dominic, I would like to react on what you say about the impact of the remediation and how to ensure or to secure the future. You know that there are some court cases in UK about the impact of remediation on the surrounding population. I'm referring to the Corby case. We discussed this last week in Trieste. And I think that's also something important to address in the issue under the sustainable remediation. If we don't want to extend that type of reaction from the surrounding population, the roadmap has also to take into consideration these type of problems or potential problems. I think the key message from the regulators' point of view is how to secure the future. And that should be part of the discussion of the sustainable remediation.
Good point. Thank you, Dominique. Okay, any questions on the phone lines? Let me take a question here on the Internet from Roger Wilkinson in the U.S. Air Force in San Antonio, Texas. And the question is the U.S. EPA considering any changes in policy or guidance that relate to the 9 criteria used to select remedies under the CERCLA that specifically address consideration of green and sustainable remedies? And what do this include? Safety concerns with implementing the remedy. So thanks for your question. We are working on some clarifying guidance with respect to green remediation and the 9 criteria. The policy shop here in Superfund is looking at that. Don't expect any radical changes, any significant changes. It'll basically clarify how within the 9 criteria green remediation can be considered. It's important from 2 points of view. One is, for example, to clarify what authorities EPA has to expend public dollars to address or to take green remediation actions or adopt best practices should they be more expensive. And, of course, what it can do to cost recovery when responsible parties are cleaned up. So basically it's clarifying where what authorities are there, but don't expect significant changes. On the question of safety concerns, that is also currently that is in CERCLA and in the NCP, and we're working on determining what the best way is to communicate or reinforce the consideration of work health and safety the way it's laid out in CERCLA and the NCP. So again, we don't expect a change there. Just clarifying or reinforcing the importance of trainings, health and safety worker. Health and safety work plans, or the auditing we do of those at sites, and what the role of OSHA and others are in that area. So thanks for your question. I hope that helps clarify it. And Lammy, any questions? Other questions on the phone lines? Okay, I'll take another one from the Internet. Chantal, you discussed the Canadian approach to sustainable remediation for federal, state-owned lands. But are there any drivers or desires? Sorry, last question here. for sustainable remediation to apply to privately owned land? And this is a question from Rick Boyle of the United Kingdom.
Okay, thanks for the question, Richard. I will need to clarify that the what I've presented today is really the federal program for federal departments. In Canada, it's really the provinces and the territories that have the broader authorities to regulate non-federal contaminated sites, so I cannot really speak on behalf of them today. And so basically there is some federal regulatory authorities that may be triggered by substances or impacts of contamination, but really private sites are really under the provincial and territorial jurisdiction.
Okay. We actually have a related question for all of us, I guess. The question is from Anthony Fong of Illinois EPA, and how are the Canadian and EU groups working with regulators at the project manager level to overcome skepticism of alternative, less energy-intensive remedies and to ease the learning curve burden? That's a great question. It's a debate that we have a clear position on here in the EPA, U.S. EPA, that no one remedy is necessarily greener than another one. We're looking at the remedy that gets us to the desired endpoint. So while some remedies are not energy or resource intensive, particularly those that manage exposed pathways versus treating the source, we're not saying that anyone is greener than another one. The question on sustainability is how is that remedy being implemented? So for example, energy intensive remedies such as in situ thermal desorption, depending on when we heat it, we've used off-peak power, if we use renewable energy, if we use renewable energy credits, et cetera, there are always opportunities to green the implementation of a remedy regardless of how which one it is or how resource-intensive it is. But I'd like to put the question out there to others. So, again, is how are we working with regulators and project managers to overcome skepticism of alternative, less energy-intensive remedies and to ease the learning curve?
Dominique, I can answer for the common forum. We are trying to inform or train our members, first of all, because, as I said, we have different level of knowledge in legal frameworks in the European countries, and we need to address more and more the basic principle to our members. But we produced 6 months ago with Nicole, for example, a joint statement paper on innovative technologies and how to promote their implementation at site level in the member states. Our idea was to find and to have additional fundings for demonstration projects and at the European level and at the member state level, and to have a memory database with all the experience we had on those innovative technologies to try to have a better acceptance by our national regulators. You could find this joint statement report on the Common Forum and the NICOL website if you want to have more information on what could be the action plan.
Thanks, Dominique. Olivier, any perspectives from Nicole?
Yeah. You want me to react to that question?
Yeah, I think it's, looking at your roadmap, it looks like something you might have come across.
Right. Well, I think in Europe, in comparison to the United States, there are still, it's probably easier in some, at least in some countries, to sit down with the project manager working, at the agency level, upfront at the beginning of the project and looking at, goals and objectives. And we think that this is really when you gain the maximum, positive outcome on the project. So, you know, we agree with what you said, Carlos, about, you know, green technologies and the fact that you need to meet an end point according to legal requirements. But we think that there's a better chance of getting better output if we all sit down very early in the project. And this is something possible, at least in some countries, not all of them.
That's a good point, Olivier. Thank you for, I guess, clarifying that. There is, all of us on the phone know, we've had this discussion before, that, and I think we all agree on that, reducing the footprint of a cleanup is not a matter of moving the endpoint so that it's, you know, for example, unrestricted reuse, you know, put some restrictions on the reuse. That's not a way, necessarily a way of greening up a remedy. However, there is a healthy discussion to be had, and what is the end use going to be, and how is that influencing remedy decisions? We have a question here from the Internet. Are you considering soil services and soil functions in sustainable remediation assessment? And if so, how? From Corinne Merly and BRGM in France. Thanks for the question. I'll take a jab at it. Ecosystem services is one of the core elements in EPA's definition of green remediation. And that's something that we've barely touched on this call, but I know there's a lot of work taking place, certainly in the United States, developing tools to quantify the footprint, environmental footprint of a remedy. So, you know, there's things, we make a distinction between a methodology and a tool. Sometimes they're closely related. Some of you may know, and unfortunately we don't have time to discuss it on this call, but for example, the U.S. Air Force has developed a tool called Sustainable Remediation Tool. There's another one out there developed by Battelle and adopted by the Navy and the Army called SiteWise. And they have, you know, they have protocols for quantifying, you know, the environmental footprint of remedies. But one area that's you know, admittedly weak right now is ecosystem services. And, of course, part of those ecosystem services are soil services. So infiltration, compaction, you know, all the services provided by soils is definitely in there. And we actually have some people looking at that this summer here in our office. So thanks for the question, Corinne. And does anybody else want to address the question of soil services and soil functions in sustainable remediation?
This is Laurent from the Netherlands. But we noticed is that it is it's upcoming. So we don't have much experience yet, but it's really a topic. If you look also at all kind of research funding programs, soil services, soil functions is now in these programs. So it's upcoming, so starting, and we think in SURVNL that it should be also considered in sustainable remediation.
Well, thank you, Laurent. Anybody else?
Carlos?
Yes. Paul?
Paul Vardis. I think ecosystem services is, well, in Surf UK, it's clearly part of the criteria we would include as indicators. But I think Loren is also correct to say that across a whole raft of policy, ecosystem services is becoming more and more a determinant of what is sustainable and what is not. And I think that might be taking us away a little bit from the kind of conventional people, planet, profit view of sustainability. I don't know what the impact of that will be on sustainable remediation frameworks in the future, but it's definitely an upcoming issue. I also wanted to come back on the question about and the lady from Illinois, was it, about how to engage with people who might be skeptical. This has been quite an important part of our discussions in Surf UK. And we think that the main answer to this is going to be leading through example with good case studies. We also see a need for training, which is, again, in line with what other speakers have said. And perhaps in the long term, some kind of recognized standard, which I know that you've begun that process in the States.
So that's my answer.
Thank you, Paul. I'll read a question that came out on the internet, although we've touched on this in the last few minutes. I guess it relates to the endpoint, but let me read it back, see if anybody can clarify it further if necessary. The question is from Simon Brooks from Harrow States in the United Kingdom, and the question is, what are the panel's thoughts on the amount of effort used in remediating a site to a certain cleanup target versus the time or cost to the various sustainability measures? For example, cleaning a compound up from 500 milligrams to kilogram to 20 can be done in 10 weeks, but from 20 to 2 will take another 10 weeks. Or treatment with the same level of social, environmental, and economic impacts. So I guess it's that discussion of should we take it down to 20 or should we stop at 200?
Can I have a crack at that, Carlos?
Please do, Paul.
Yes. I think that this question is one of the key drivers of the sustainable remediation debate. It depends on so many whatevers. It depends on what the compound is, what the use of the site is, how conservative the assumptions were to get to the 2 milligrams per kilogram target. I think that there's a lot of worry from regulators that people want to use sustainability as some kind of an excuse to somehow do less. But on the other hand, I think it's perfectly proper to ask, is it appropriate to remediate if the cure is worse than a disease? And I know that this is a question that we have a specific subgroup on in the Nicole Initiative, which maybe Olivier can tell us more about. Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, good point. And it raises a broader question of sustainability. It moves away almost from a site-level decision to a, you know, societal decision. And one point that we try to clarify is when we start to get to that scale, another factor starts to play in. So here in the U.S., you know, we're looking that in the next 20 years, there'll be an additional 60 million people will join the population of this country. And in Europe, for example, while there is generally higher population density, population growth is pretty much flattened out, whereas here it's continuing. So those 60 million people are going to need a place to live. And the opportunities that the brownfield or contaminated sites provide, usually when those sites are already in existing urban in those cities, for redevelopment are more sustainable than building green space where we'd have to build infrastructure, roads, power, sewage, et cetera. So if we step back and look at it, okay, if we do not clean up sites so that they can be reused, let's say unrestricted reuse, the unrestricted reuse has to go elsewhere, and it will likely be to a green field, which will require development, building of infrastructure, et cetera. So it comes into a broader sustainability discussion of should we be fostering infill, urban infill, more aggressively, for example, by cleaning up sites to the point necessary where any end use is possible. So again, just wanted to put it out there as part of that that discussion on the whole concept of sustainability and site cleanup. Any other thoughts?
Yes, Dominic, I would like to answer to this question too. I think what you said is clearly a crucial point, and it's regional or site-specific. And it would be better, I think, to set some useful criteria to solve the question at the local level, better to try to have an harmonized position. We discussed a lot of this within the common forum, and that's the current state of the point of view of the regulators members.
Okay. Thank you, Dominique. Just in case, let me ask
Carlos, I mean, this is Olivier. Maybe I can also add something here.
Thank you, Olivier.
The one thing we found out in our discussions with the Nicole work group is that once, you know, there's a decision taken by the stakeholders at the beginning of the project agreeing on an endpoint, for example, there is still room during the project to go back based on performance, you know, based on the kind of demonstration you make of your performance with a risk assessment, with monitoring programs, to always go back to your earlier discussion and revise your endpoint if necessary. I mean, and this iterative process, for example, is very important in France in the way France manages contaminated sites. And, you know, some of us believe that this is a very useful process strategy to come with, you know, solutions that are more common sense.
Yeah, and I also want to thank you, Olivia. I also wanted to mention that sometimes I get a perception, or there is a perception out there, that EPA requires that every site be cleaned up to background levels, and that is certainly not the case. You know, some may argue that that's what should be happening, that sites should be left in the condition they were before, you know, before they were contaminated. But in fact, in a recent report that we'll be releasing soon, a recent study, we found that 90% of the Superfund records of decision documents, that where we document what's going to be done to clean up a site, 90% of them have some form of institutional control. So, you know, we are, you know, using, you know, the whole toolbox to be protective of human health and the environment. And that includes sometimes, putting some type of institutional control in where we're restricting site use in some form or another. Okay, so we're down to the last minutes here. There's a question here from the Internet. Sustainability assessments may suffer from various perceptions and views from the different stakeholders. How important is it for the presenters? How important do the presenters see it is to defining boundaries and undertaking sensitivity analyses? Great question. The question of boundaries is a really big one. We've touched on it a little bit. Let me just put it out there, see if somebody wants to tackle that one.
Well, I can take a crack at that if you want. This is Olivier.
Thank you.
It's something we discussed last week in our last meeting with the NICOL work group, including the sensitivity analysis. We think that, you know, defining boundaries is critical, again, at the early stage of a project. It's not very difficult. We don't see that as a difficult item. You know, it's just about defining boundary conditions of the project, either on site, off site, until where you go. I mean, this is basic discussions to among the stakeholders. Now, on the sensitivity analysis, it's also something which is part of what is required of a number of national methodologies when managing sustainable, managing remediation projects. We don't think it's something that should be prescriptive in the NICOL roadmap or guidance document, but it is clearly something needed if you want to build trust and consensus among stakeholders. So, you know, those two conditions, boundary conditions and sensitivity analysis, are important.
Thank you. And the sensitivity analysis, also wanted to bring something up that's a really important one. We're working on corporate methodology here in EPA as well. And one of the things we're looking at is, you know, finding out or trying to determine, you know, how can we best identify that 20% of activities that's resulting in 80% of the footprint, regardless of the site. So let's not go chasing that last gram of NOx when just around a corner we have hundreds of tons of waste of construction demolition debris, for example, that's being trucked off-site. There are two things there. One is, you know, the sensitivity analysis to find those bigger numbers, but will also help us avoid situations of greenwashing where somebody can claim they took action to address some component of a footprint, but decided to ignore the rest of it. So both those hopefully will are affected, I guess, in a sense, by the sensitivity analysis. Any other
comments?
Yeah.
From First UK's perspective, and I'll try and be quick, I think that boundaries and sensitivity analysis, well, I think we believe that they're important because if you pick the boundaries, you can to some extent dictate the answer that you will get. And if you don't consider the boundaries, then you may not be comparing like with like. So just so we're all on the same page, I think we're talking here about the system boundary. What is the project that we're considering? And what are its impacts, whether they're local or distant, temporary or permanent?
Mm-hmm.
There's a life cycle boundary. For example, you might say something like, we'll consider the effects of what is consumed by the project, but not the impacts of producing capital equipment, like the diggers, for example. That's a boundary you can choose. You might also want to choose boundaries related to proximity, for example, to define some kind of an operational area so you can distinguish local from distant effects. And maybe something to do with permanence, for example, related to the duration of the project so you can distinguish what effects are temporary and what effects are permanent. So I think that those are important universally, to be honest. For sensitivity analyses, fully agree with what you said, Carlos. But I would also say that I think they can be a tool to help stakeholders reach a consensus. If you have a situation where, let's say, there are five different groups who are involved and three of them are holding out for one particular set of indicators and another two are holding out for a different set of indicators, then you can run a sensitivity analysis on your sustainability appraisal to see what the impact of having those two different sets of indicators actually is. And it may not be great, so why have a big argument about it? So that's the end of my answer.
Great. Well, I appreciate it, Paul. And with that, we are at 11:59. We're aiming to end at noon, so we'll wrap it up. I'd like to thank all of the speakers for taking time to prepare for this session. Thank you so much for being so timely and sticking to those 10 minutes. I know it's hard to convey a lot of information in such little time. Thanks to those participating over the Internet and on the phone lines. Appreciate the questions you came in. We hope this was informative. And please stay tuned to kluna.org/greenremediation for further information and other activities and that we have not been able to include in this seminar. And again, if you're interested in console and participating in that event, the URL is console, www.consoil.de. You can get information on that agenda. And then we will be taking some training to consoil on green remediation, EPA will. And after console, we plan to have that same training delivered over an internet seminar format. It is on a 90-minute training on environmental footprints. So thank you again for everybody for participating, and bye-bye.